FTX co-founder Sam Bankman-Fried is heading to prison for a very long time. Artificial intelligence continues to disrupt markets, including beer making and songwriting. And NVIDIA not only becomes the new cool kid at the table, they own the entire school. We're going to talk about those stories and more on this episode of Today in Tech. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Today in Tech. I'm Keith Shaw. The guy behind the monitors is Chris. Hello, Chris.
What's up?
Joining us again as our guest co-host this week is Brandon Maney. He is owner of the Mangrove Collection in San Francisco, as well as the CTO of Glasshouse. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we're jumping right into the fire with the first topic here. Sam Bankman-Fried was sentenced to 25 years for the FTX fraud scheme. Basically, 300 months in prison, 25 years for 7 counts of conspiracy and fraud stemming from the collapse of the crypto exchange he started. The judge applied a 240-month sentence and a 60-month sentence to be conserved consecutively. Judge Lewis Kaplan's sentence was shorter than the 40 to 50 years requested by prosecutors, which he said was more than necessary, but longer than the 6.5 years that Bankman-Fried's lawyers had asked for, and far less than the maximum sentence of 110 years. Again, if you go into the comments of this Verge article, people are already arguing about how long he's actually going to have to serve. This is federal prison, so that you do not get kind of 50% time served for good behavior. I think it's only 85% of the sentence. So most people think he's going to be serving for about 20 years. Before announcing the sentence, Inner City Press reported that Judge Kaplan called the defense's claims that people would be paid back speculative, finding that customers of FTX lost $8 billion and that Bankman-Fried attempted to tamper with witnesses, perjured himself, and falsely testified about when he learned of the missing $8 billion. There's a quote in this story that I find it, you know, kind of entertaining as well. Despite a jump in the value of FTX's crypto holdings or its stake in the AI company Anthropic, which we're going to get to in a second, Kaplan said, basically, quote, "A thief who takes his loot to Las Vegas and successfully bets the stolen money is not entitled to a discount on the sentence by using his Las Vegas winnings to pay back all or part of which he stole when he finally gets caught," which I guess is implying that because the stock is now worth more, or the company has got more money back, that they'll use that to pay back the victims. That doesn't necessarily get you off the hook when it comes to sentencing. So again, this is still developing. Brandon, was the FTX fraud scheme, was that a big deal in Silicon Valley? Because you're in the heart of San Francisco. Do you find a lot of people talking about it here on the East Coast? I think it was interesting from the business side of things and not the Silicon Valley type of companies.
On the West Coast in San Francisco, Silicon Valley, it was huge.
Yeah.
And you know, hearing about Steph Curry taking and being pulled in, and the utter, you know, length and size of what this scandal meant, and how broad it was, where crypto was, you know, the hottest new thing that was talked about at every happy hour in the Bay Area, and then to see it fall in this way and this Ponzi scheme, it's fascinating. It's crazy.
Yeah, here on the East Coast, I think it was all Tom Brady and how much money he lost from him and Giselle at the time had invested. You know, and it was the whole celebrity angle of it as well. But we talked about this on our shows when he was found guilty and when the fraud was first exposed, when he first got arrested and all that was. You know, what does this mean for the crypto industry? Just from a mainstream perspective, I'm approaching it from mainstream because every time I would just approach by anybody trying to pitch me on crypto, I just roll my eyes, and you could kind of tell that there was something scammy about the whole thing, and so to be proven right on this, you're going to have to do a lot more to convince me that crypto moving forward is safe, secure, not a fraud, not a scheme type of a thing.
I think it's moving them back, right? They have to earn back that trust. I think that it, just like any form of currency or gambling or whatever you want to call it, where you put alternative currency, there's always going to be interest in it. There's always going to be big winners, and that's going to draw people to take those chances. Maybe this slows it down, but I'm sure that there's the next coin that's just waiting in the wings.
Yeah. What was interesting to me also too was, the government doesn't like people that con other people, or it, you know, again, this is like Bernie Madoff level.
Only the government is allowed to con people. Okay.
There you go.
But right. No one else.
Right. Right. Only certain types of people are allowed to steal money from other people and get away with it. Like, you know, so, you know, was it the brash lifestyle? Was it the fact that he was this golden boy in the crypto space? I think if you look at it from a legal standpoint as well, he didn't help himself. His case was not defended very well. You know, the government wants to make an example for other people out there. He did not cooperate. They circled the wagons and got other people to testify against him. Like it didn't seem like a good deal from the start for him. So sometimes someone has to be the sacrificial goat, right?
Yeah, if you want, you know, to be infamous, if you want to be the big cheese, that, you know, I sort of take it as like the T-Rex principle, right? If you want to be really successful, you just don't move and you sort of avoid the fame and you're going to be just fine. But if you're out there on, you know, making headlines and trying to be a personality, you're going to open yourself up to that scrutiny and they're going to look closer and closer and closer.
Yeah. Chris, any other thoughts on this, like from either a tech or a culture standpoint?
I mean, cultural standpoint, F around, find out. This is just the continuation of, you know, when he actually did it. I mean, it just makes sense, you know?
Well, okay, right. I guess if you wanted to be not put in prison, don't con people. But you know, you've got other business leaders and billionaires and, you know, in the Silicon Valley space, the cynical side of me was like, well, they just do a better job of hiding some of their schemes or their plans. And certainly it, from a cultural standpoint, you can't get too popular or someone will start taking pot shots at you.
Yeah.
You see that in the political space and you see that in celebrity world. You see that in, you know, Elon Musk, certainly he was like a golden boy for a long time. And now people are really seeing, you know, they're taking shots at him left and right.
Correct.
and I bring this up for Chris's sake, because we want to talk about NVIDIA. Let's jump to the NVIDIA stuff. You know, is this are they the new golden boy or the new golden child that everyone is loving? Chris, you know, I'm going to call you a member of the cult of NVIDIA. You love everything that they're doing. We didn't get a chance to talk about this last week, but you know, they announced this big Blackwell chip platform. Everybody seems to be like, oh, this is great. The valuation of the company is amazing. I did a thing. My first intro had said it's the new cool kid at the lunch table, and you're like, they own the whole school. So. Tell me about your love of this company and Jensen Huang.
Oh, I mean, I love NVIDIA, you know, personally, just because of their GPUs.
Yeah.
You know, as a semi part-time gamer these days, you know, whenever I get the opportunity, you know, I can rely on NVIDIA's GPUs, right? Before they got into AI, when you would type in NVIDIA into Google, they would say, you know, they were a GPU company for gaming. Right, they were in the gaming market. Now, right. When you type in NVIDIA, they're an AI company. So I think they've really seen the opportunity where they can kind of grow exponentially with AI, because AI is they're just taking advantage of the GPU to help, you know, servers and you know, cloud applications perform, you know, at peak performance with GPU. So I think NVIDIA's, you know, they're just going to capitalize on that. And what they did with Blackwell was just, I mean, I think it's two or three dies that have been butted together to make this one chip. It's crazy what they're doing. And I think they're only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. I think they've been the golden child for the last 4 to 5 years now, I think. That's just my estimation, just from how fast they've been evolving.
Yeah, I mean, this one
as a company.
This one article says that they are now the world's third most valuable business.
Yeah.
So, okay, so maybe me claiming that they're the new cool kid. I mean, basically, this cool kid is pushing every other company out of the way.
I mean,
as well, you know. in my ecosphere, when you look at the large tech companies, you start talking Microsoft, Apple, Google, and Nvidia is just kind of they might be more valuable. Maybe they're the rich kid at the table that someone finally notices. Yeah. And they're like, whoa, this kid's got all this money. Let's hang out with him now.
I mean, I think they've been there. They've been the cool kids. It's just you don't really notice them. You don't see them. They're kind of there in the shadows. Like when people think of GPUs, you know, it's not like some sort of sexy, you know, thing.
It hasn't been sexy until AI.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I'd even say like one, you know how autonomous vehicles, they, you know, had their run and stuff and how they were going to have the smart cars communicate with one another through the cloud. One of those components was from NVIDIA, their GPU processors. They were going to have that in every autonomous vehicle, right? To help, you know, each car communicate with one another. So, like, they've been there just in the background.
Yeah.
You know, they've been, like, playing it real quiet until AI comes out. Then they're like, bam.
Yeah.
Look what we can do.
Yeah. And now everyone else is now playing catch up with them on the processor side, too. Intel and AMD are just looking at this kid, you know, this company going, wow.
So actually, this is going to be a good opportunity for NVIDIA's competition, such as Intel, AMD, because again, I think NVIDIA's approach right now is going to be AI. And I'd say like 80% of the time, they're still going to make, you know, consumer graphics, consumer GPUs.
Yep.
But now Intel and AMD are going to come in and be like, well, wait a minute. Let's keep our GPUs a little bit more affordable for the the everyday gamer, while NVIDIA is always going to be the high-end, super high-end gamer, right? You know, I have like a $4,000, $5,000, you know, desktop CPU gaming machine, right? I'm probably going to get NVIDIA. But for everybody else who's just getting started, you know, start out in gaming or, you know, maybe don't have the budget for a super high-end gaming, well, I think that's Intel and AMD's opportunity right now. So it's interesting. It's because again, I remember going to Circuit City when I was a kid and going to the PC section, like after work, I'd be on a lunch, my little 15-minute lunch break, and I'd play, Command and Conquer or Age of Empires 3. Yeah. And like in that row, they'd have NVIDIA GPUs and they were, you know, they looked skinny and scrawny. They were very small back then. And, you know, they didn't have the big heat sink blocks on it and stuff like that. But it's like, oh, wow, that's cool. I can buy this chip and I can elevate my gaming. But now, yeah, I think they're evolving so quickly into a whole new market.
Yeah.
You know, well, it's interesting. It's interesting to see.
And again, like the generative AI space where you have generative AI that can benefit a lot of different markets. It's the same thing with these chips. It's not just putting them into a computer.
Right.
It's putting them into a data center. It's putting them into, you know, little IoT type things. It's, you know, you saw a rush of devices at CES this year from like Microsoft and Lenovo and Dell. And, you know, here's all of our AI chips that are going to get into our, you know, and of course with, you know, I don't think anybody cares as much about notebook computers as much as they used to. But then you saw Samsung with its Galaxy smartphones, and they're like, we're going to start putting AI chips and AI software into the phones. They're all, you know, and Meta, for example, they invested a whole ton of money. They bought a lot of NVIDIA stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, you've got a picture on the screen here with Jensen Huang showing off all these robots. In the robotic space, this is not the first time that they've shown this, you know, the ability with robots. They had a Jetson platform, I believe, was the one before the last one, which was the Hopper chip. So it's like Blackwell, Hopper, Jetson was one of them. They I think they had a couple before that. So they've always been in the robotic space as well, with chipsets that were I don't know,
commercial applications.
Yeah.
They've always been there.
Platforms,
military.
Again, they've got a broad range, and again, it's not just gaming; it's also all these other markets. You know,
I think from an engineering side, the cool part to me is that you're seeing both sides of the pendulum, right? You see software and AI taking and driving chip manufacturing and hardware, then hardware takes and catches up, and you're seeing sort of that full synergy, both sides of the yin and the yang, that lead to great customer developments, great, you know, innovation that we're seeing across the board. Like, what a time where all of these things are moving forward so quickly in parallel, and NVIDIA is helping to drive, and that, you know, the landscape is changing so rapidly.
Just don't become too obsessed with the cult of NVIDIA, Chris. That's if you start showing up to work in a leather jacket, like, you know, he comes out on stage in a leather jacket, right?
A leather bomber jacket. Yeah. Oh yeah, no, that's his look.
Now, Brandon, you're in Silicon Valley. You remember the whole when everyone started trying to dress like Steve Jobs?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think Tim Cook tried to do it with like the dress shirt, but not tucked in, like, you know. You let me, you know, have you seen people starting to wear, you know, leather bomber jackets around?
You know, here in San Francisco, it's still the Patagonia vest. I haven't seen bomber jackets totally, you know, come in, but the uniform for the techies is always evolving at a very slow rate.
Oh, that Patagonia vest thing annoys the heck out of me. I have to wear that for my other show, for the demo show. I have to wear like a Patagonia vest. I hope my overlords didn't hear me say that. Because again, I'm a hoodie guy, which is like, this was like popular by Mark Zuckerberg 20 years ago when he launched Facebook. Yep. I just wear it for comfort. I'm not trying to make any kind of fashion statement at all.
I mean, as a fractional CTO, most of my wardrobe comes from the companies that I take and I get to service. And so I will take any of the swag. I love it all.
What? Okay, so you haven't seen anybody yet with the bomber jacket look yet. That would be the real indication of the culture changing then, right?
No.
Like, I think it would.
For all of the NVIDIA fans out there, they are the gamers. Those are the fans.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think we're gonna don leather jackets all of a sudden. It's just, you know, we like their GPUs. They have really powerful GPUs, you know. So I wouldn't really call it a cult per se, just, you know, they make good stuff.
You know? Okay. But now they've got such, you know, the spotlight is now on them even brighter, I think.
Now all the other corporations are becoming NVIDIA fanboys now, because they're all going to use their GPUs and stuff like that. Right. Amazon especially.
Yeah.
And Google.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Their AI applications there.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's also interesting that at the same time that you see how much NVIDIA is becoming popular, and with investors and fans and users and companies and things like that, you start seeing established companies that are, you know, facing some difficult times ahead. You know, Google is certainly, there's been a lot of stories about Google and how its culture has changed, and there's not a lot of innovation going on, and they screwed up with this Gemini AI, and, you know, and there's rumors that they're going to team up with Apple for its AI, and everyone's going, why would you want to do that? And, and now we're seeing another, you know, we're seeing, Apple gets sued by the DOJ. We didn't get a chance to talk. That broke right after our episode last week. Right. You know, I have seen some articles where people are trying to defend Apple and say, well, they're not really a monopoly because you could always buy a Samsung Galaxy phone. And, you know, I think if you read the lawsuit, the DOJ does have some good points that Apple is trying to, whether or not there's a legal argument about Apple is trying to use its monopoly power to prevent you from going to another device or prevent you from a watch,
right,
from a different company. That's different than forcing you to using monopoly to make you buy its product. I think that's the little difference between the Microsoft case in the 90s. Like in the 90s, Microsoft was using its power to basically make you buy Windows or make you use Internet Explorer, preventing other options out there. This case, it's, you're already locked into an ecosystem if you're an Apple person. And they're saying that's not fair for consumers to then do more work or prevent you from going to other systems. Yeah. Like is the Apple DOJ thing a big deal out where you are, Brandon?
It is, and I think it's mainly in the developer community. You know, as the fees and the 30% for in-app purchases, like, I think that's what I'm hearing the most about.
Right.
The control that the App Store has, you know, provided in the last 10, 12 years, in first sort of being a darling of the developer community, bring them together, giving them power, giving them a distribution mechanism, and then just tightening those screws on the power that they have, where they can make money off of, you know, the initial 99-cent app download that developers would get. You've seen that power swing back, and I think that the engineers are pleased, and they're saying, we've been talking about this for a long time. We're glad somebody finally listened.
Right, right. If you talk to kind of a man on the street who doesn't necessarily know what was going on in terms of the guts of the lawsuit, they would look at it and go, well, Apple's not a monopoly because I can go and buy a Samsung phone, or I can, you know, there's a couple of other smartwatches available.
Green bubbles and blue bubbles, right? What are my text messages? Oh, you're a green bubble guy. I'm not going to, you know, that, why would you sue over that? That's no big deal.
Right, right. And, you know, and so, yeah, I just think that that's a cursory look at it. You have to look at the specifics, and that that 30% figure that they charge is pretty high, and you saw that with the Epic Games lawsuit that Apple won, but they lost it against, or that Epic won against Google, and then the Spotify case as well. So there are other companies out there that are that have a legit beef against Apple, and then you saw what Europe is doing, where Europe is kind of forcing everybody to have to play nicer again. We should all just move to Europe.
And where we talk about like SaaS subscriptions, right?
Yeah.
Like my business, does that count? Should you be able to sign up for a plan? And does Apple get a portion of that if they're using their app? The implications for Slack and all these other things that are driving parts of the economy. It's money. It's going to take a long time to figure out. This isn't going to be overnight or by the end of the year. So not only what the rulings are, but what it means in the long term. It's interesting, but doesn't really matter right
now. So what I also wanted to raise was, you know, so again, you see some companies that are kind of going down in public perception, and then, and you know, you've got NVIDIA, but then now you've also got Anthropic. So this week, for example, Amazon said it's going to spend $2.75 billion on Anthropic with its largest venture investment yet. And so Anthropic has the GPT called Claude, right? And that's kind of also kind of snuck in under the radar, at least maybe from our thinking over here on the East Coast. It's, you know, OpenAI right now is the big darling, and they've got all the money from Microsoft. Google is, you know, has its, you know, it used Gemini. To be called Bard and then Gemini, but they just keep stumbling over themselves with problems. So, you know, in the meantime, like, you don't see a lot of stories about, you know, oh, Claude did this wrong or Claude did that wrong. You just kind of like, people just keep putting more and more money in it, and then they release it. And then I did see one article was like, Claude 3 is now more popular on some site that's ranking, you know, usage of these GPTs. I don't know.
It beat ChatGPT 3 or 4 from OpenAI just earlier this week in some of the metrics that they were tracking.
Right, right. So again, is that another case of just someone kind of creeping in under the radar, and maybe if more and more media attention gets paid to this, then they might start seeing some holes, or is it legit? Have you tried Claude at all?
I have not, but now I'm going to. I'm going to go
see, look that's, at it. Yeah, that's what you do. You start hearing about something and you go try it out.
And say, hey, maybe this is better. Maybe it's different. You got to find the right technology for the right use case and for where you are. I think that OpenAI and ChatGPT are just so available right now.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the next point in the maturity curve where people start to look for alternatives, whether it be on cost, whether it be on accuracy. You can only take and differentiate on so many levels, but competition's good.
What's also interesting to me is to see the companies that don't have kind of a pawn in the game. And so Amazon, obviously, either the stuff maybe they were working on internally, they just be like, well, no. And they just decided, well, we've got a big bucket full of money. Let's just throw it out there for companies that, you know, for a company that isn't OpenAI, because they've already got their money. And Amazon's like, well, these Anthropic guys, they don't have a big competitor investor, do they? I think they're getting money from a lot of different people.
Yeah. I think the other interesting part, you know, you talked about Gemini. For whatever reason, I've been getting just advertised, like media blitzed, how much better Gemini is, the leaps and bounds that they're making, that it's everywhere, it's powering all these different things. And I haven't gone back and looked at it probably since, August of last year.
Yeah.
That would be another curious piece if you're looking at all three. You know, it's not going to disrupt search, but how can it work alongside you? I don't know.
From the search standpoint, I'm still, again, as you get older, you sort of get stuck in your ways, Brandon. I'm giving you a little warning about about what happens when you get older.
My future.
Yeah. So again, I've used Google search, for most of my adult life when Google has been around. And so when I'm still searching, I'll still use I use the Google Chrome browser and I'll read the Gemini results. I actively have to go to my OpenAI subscription, but I think that their search engine is still not powered by, it's still not a search engine if on the OpenAI site. Then I think you have to go, Microsoft keeps getting in its own way too, where it's like, should I go to Bing to try to find this answer? And it's like, you get to the Bing homepage and there's like 17 ads and 15 news stories and pop-ups and it's like, okay, I don't want any of that. I just want an answer to my question on how long I should cook my chicken for.
If I need to find something that I'm going to, as an input to what I'm doing, I'll go to Google and I'll search. If I need something done, that's where I go to OpenAI and I say, write this script or make a recommendation. What should I get my wife for her birthday? Like, that's the easy stuff. I don't Google that. I build me a list off of.
So that's why I think the Anthropic stuff is interesting too, because now it's like, well, maybe I have an alternative, but how would I know if something is better or not better? Unless it's the image drawing, maybe it's like, okay, well, you got that image right or this poem is better or this story idea is better. Again, I just think that Anthropic is under the radar at the moment. So like you, I'm probably going to go and check it out and see what I can produce. So speaking of disruptions in AI, the other big story this week was this viral song creator. It's called Suno. Basically, we've talked about images. We've talked about voice replicators. Now there's apparently this tool, it's called Suno AI. You can type in a text prompt and it'll create a song for you of 2 minutes. And it's goofy, it's fun, and it also will kind of blow your mind.
It's really fun.
Okay, so good. Every time I try to give Chris a new tool, he just kind of rolls his eye at me. And so this is the segment where Chris is going to roll his eyes. Okay, so I've got my, this is what I want to do with you, Brandon, and I didn't talk about this with you beforehand. So I've got an account. You get 50 credits for free a day.
Yep.
I think each song is 10 credits. Correct. So you can basically have it do 5 songs. Now, for some reason, it does 2 songs at a time for me. So
me too. I think it's a bug, right?
So I want you to come up with a prompt and I'll type it in here. And then at the end of the show, we'll play the result.
That sounds amazing. So I've been playing with this a lot. I spent all last night playing songs for my kids. I did a power pop punk rock ballad to My Little Ponies that was amazing, that I played for my daughter this morning as we were getting ready for school. I think it's so much fun. I have text messages. So since I found this week with all of my buddies who have been in the music industry or in bands, we're each making all kinds of different songs. But what I will tell you, if we do one, I was taking and doing drop off on my dad bike for gymnastics earlier this week, and there was no parking. There was no bike parking because all the other dad bikes were there. And I would love to hear.
What's a dad bike?
So out here, parking's really hard. So it's an e-bike, like a cargo e-bike, like a rad wagon or a Turn. I've owned both, and I can fit both kids on the back and get up the hills because it's electric. And they are very popular, especially in some of the more populated areas of San Francisco when you're trying to drop off a bunch of kids.
Okay.
I'm going to have to add that to my dad vocabulary list. Dad bike.
Okay. I'm gonna have it create a song about no parking for the dad bike. Okay.
No parking for the dad bike.
A song. Okay, hold on. A song about Brandon. About a man named Brandon who cannot find parking for his dad bike downtown in the style of, what kind of style do you want?
Let's do some shoegaze.
What the heck? What the hell is
See how good this is.
Remember, I'm old. Is that a band or a style? It has to be a style because you can't actually put in a band name because technically I think they don't have the licenses and, you know, the...
So shoegaze is a style.
All right. Spell that for me.
Melodic rock.
Spell it.
Yes.
How do you spell it?
S-H-O-E-G-A-Z-E.
S-H-O-E-G-A-Z-E. Right?
Yep.
Okay.
Gaze at one's shoes to look down.
Okay. I'm going to create it. And now I do want to talk about some other stuff about this, about this generator. Just quickly, yeah. I did one song about a podcaster named Keith in the style of a 1980s girl band. And actually the title was Keith's Got the Beat, which is a little bit too on the nose for me because it was like, okay, it's thinking of the Go-Go's. But then the style was more of like a Madonna slash Debbie Harry Blondie type song. Because I said 80s pop and I should have done 80s girl rock band type thing. Mm. And then I decided to start writing songs about my two dogs. I have a beagle and a cockapoo. And so we did one that was, it was called Best Friends Forever in the style of a 1970s acoustic rock, or acoustic folk. So it was kind of like a Harry Chapin Cats in the Cradle type song. Okay. But then I wrote one about how much they love following my wife around because she's the alpha dog in the house. And so they follow her around all the time because she's the one who feeds them and walks them the most. And that one was in the style of like a British New Wave Invasion, and that was called Housebound Love, which again, it's an amazing song. And so my wife was like, this is really, really, really cool. All right. So as we speak, it's now coming up. The song title it's come up with was for you, Brandon, was Asphalt Blues. Which it says atmospheric shoegaze dreamy. So we're gonna play that at the end of the show. And
all right.
So, but I do want to talk about. I find it this interesting from anybody that creates a song could be in trouble here. At least, I mean, it's not like it's going to disrupt. I don't think it's going to disrupt the entire songwriting industry because when you see the lyrics, you can obviously tell that it's like a ChatGPT type of song lyric generator.
They're very fun. Yeah.
What's interesting to me is that it combines the lyric generation with the song creation, and they have not revealed, like, the training data. I hope they didn't train this on copyrightable song styles. But if you think about it, there's so many royalty-free
songs.
Audio songs out there. You know, for example, you could probably take the entire library that YouTube has under the... Mm-hmm. Is it Creative Commons... Chris, like there's a lot of, could you take a lot of those songs and then just train the data on the royalty free audio? It's the same kind of feeling when you look for like a background audio in a, you know, if you're putting back, you know, background audio in.
Yeah, you could do that.
So they could train the data on all of the royalty free stuff that's out there. And that's things like, you know, funky electric cello type of things. So, yeah. But then it has voices as well, so the voices don't sound robotic at all.
They're fine, yeah.
Yeah. I just think we're going to need to see if the music industry gets really upset about this or what kind of... Like right now, it's that first initial week of everyone wants to try it and everyone wants to talk about it. And then, you know, and then, of course, it's the end of the world for songwriters. Obviously, the first thing we talk about is fear. But if you were in the business of creating theme songs for something, you know, or you know, you could do something like this and generate it without having to then, I guess, again, hire a songwriter. And now, of course, you're putting the songwriter out of.
I mean, there was an article about OpenAI going to Hollywood and trying to pitch how they were going to, you know, help with writing and directing and the animated, you know, creation of content. If I think about what my kids are already watching on Netflix or on Disney Plus, like that could be the same way. There may be a time ahead of us where you just ask for a show that's in your mind and it creates a theme song from this and it can animate it all out where you're getting the exact content that you want that was in your brain as it comes up. And I don't know, that seems cool.
Yeah. but it's terrifying at the same time too, right?
It is. Yeah, what is that going to do to us? That's crazy.
All right, so the song is up. We're going to save it. So, you know, because there are a couple of other stories I want to talk about. The second one about AI that was disrupting a market was scientists are turning to AI to make beer taste even better. This is the Guardian story. Yep. Okay. So whether you prefer a fruity lambic or a complex Trappist, Belgian beers have long been famed for their variety, quality, and heritage. Now researchers say they have harnessed the power of artificial intelligence to make brews even better. Professor Kevin Verstrepin of KU Leuven University, who led the research, said AI could help tease apart the complex relationships involved in human aroma perception. Beer, like most food products, contains hundreds of different aroma molecules that get picked up by our tongue and our nose, and our brain then integrates these into one picture. However, the compounds interact with each other, so how we perceive one depends also on the concentration of the others. They basically analyzed the chemical makeup of 250 commercial Belgian beers of 22 different styles, including lagers, fruit beers, blondes, West Flanders ales, and non-alcoholic beers. And then they had a tasting panel. I don't even remember what the AI part of this was, but it's probably in there and probably somewhere about taking all the data that they got. And somehow the implication was that they were going to use AI to basically create better beer. Better tasting beer.
Try to figure out, because like the thing with beer is like, you know, it's a chemical process, right? Technically. So it's like when you're done making a batch, you need to know what it's going to taste like. So I think that's where they're going to use AI to help determine, okay, what mixes of, you know, like this barley or something, putting that together, what is it going to taste like at the end once it's done brewing?
Yeah.
At least that's my guess. I mean, it says, basically says it right here.
Now, so I'm going to admit up front, I'm not a beer guy. I was a beer guy, but I wasn't one of those beer snobs. You all know what a beer snob is, right? It's like a wine snob, but with beer.
Keith, you're a fruit juice connoisseur.
Cider. I'm a cider guy at this point. I just decided to switch over. I just kind of got tired of the beer drinking aspect of drinking. I could switch to hard liquor if I wanted to, but I'm not a whiskey guy. I'm not like a scotch guy. I'm not those types of people. I'm just, so cider is safe for me. I can get away with it. It looks kind of like a beer, but isn't. But I have friends that love the microbrew aspect and how the world changed from these, you know, from these big beer manufacturers to, you know, now you can go in and buy, you know, so many different beers that you know, our D&D group every week, there's always guys bringing in, and they're always offering me, is like, no, I'll pass. I'll either have my one cider or I won't drink that night.
Like a 14% triple or something that they found in somebody's like.
All I can imagine is that these friends of mine that have these beer snobbiness tendencies. I won't call them beer snobs, but like the tendencies. Would be just like going, oh, I can't believe, you know, are their heads going to explode because, you know, AI is going to take, well, and not take over, but would they be offended by this? Because I also know people that brew their own beer and they get very technical and very like, oh, this is an art form and all that.
You know,
offend you, Brandon? I don't even know if you're a beer guy or not.
So I'm a beer guy. Okay. When I moved to San Francisco back in 2007, I got into the home brewing scene. It was a nice way to meet some folks at UCSF. And so I'm intimately aware of the balance. And I think, you know, when it comes to brewing, there are two types of people, much sort of like in the cooking space, that either you're a cook where you can throw a bunch of stuff together and you love what comes out and you tweak it a little bit here and there, and it's playful, or you're a baker, right? You follow the instructions exactly what comes out. I think that what this AI, if at least from my perspective, it's splitting those two, that you aren't going to care because you're just throwing a bunch of stuff in a pot and you're boiling it and you want to go and hand it out to your buddies. Cool. You don't care what AI says. But if you're a baker and you want to get the perfect lager that's right at 4.8% and rice, you know, as far as barley and mash, those are the people that are like, sure, I'll let AI run this because I want the perfect exact result every time and I want it to be his best. I want that consistency.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's enough room for everybody, but I think that's the interesting part. It's not going to change those cooks' minds.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't even know how much AI has disrupted the banking side of the world as well. Again, I'm probably fall on the side of I follow the directions, and it's usually I'm making it from a mix. I'm not using the scratch ingredients. So that's even how, you know, again, when they say if you want to make a cake, you have three options. You can either build it from scratch from all of the different ingredients, flour, butter, sugar, et cetera, et cetera. You can buy a box from Betty Crocker that says here's, you just add eggs and mix, or you can buy a pre-made cake. So I fall into either. No, I fall either basically into the box mix in the middle or the just buy whatever the grocery store baker's already made. Again, the same thing probably with, you know, you can homebrew or you can buy a kit or you can, you know, go to the store and buy beer.
I mean, and you even see it out of the market, right? Like Anheuser-Busch is probably going to love this because it's a quality control in their manufacturing. And then they can make sure that every single can of Budweiser tastes the same and that they're producing the same thing.
But doesn't it already?
I would hope so. I don't know, a Lagunitas or when you make your name on different brews and different kinds and you don't necessarily need that consistency.
Yeah.
I don't know. It'd still be nice from an advertising perspective that, oh, AI said that this was better than the competition or ranked a 9.4 on Beer Advocate or whatever.
Hey, Chris, I feel like you're a Scotch and whiskey guy, or you're making bathtub gin somewhere in a basement.
No, I'm more of the moonshine guy. I'm down there in the basement. I got my overalls and banjo going.
Yep, and then you drive race cars real fast to get to avoid the prohibition feds.
Is it because of the beard?
Yeah, it is.
That's what I thought, Keith.
Well, plus that you're a crazy conspiracy theorist when it comes to a lot of different issues.
Ah. No, I mean,
what is your alcohol of choice? Is it beer or is it harder liquor?
I mean, it's not really, it's
none.
Nothing as of late.
Okay.
Mainly just water.
That's true, because you are a gym guy. You're a gym guy now. Yeah.
And a dad, so I just don't want to, you know, I just want to ease back a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'll partake in some drinking only when for social events.
Sure.
You know, like hang out with friends at a restaurant or something.
Okay.
You know.
All right.
But, yeah.
Good for you, Chris.
Nothing too crazy.
All right. I was going to ask if AI had maybe infiltrated some of the, because you don't see a lot of people doing home liquor creation.
we did one of those homebrew kits. It was probably a year ago during the year or two during the pandemic.
Yeah, it didn't it take off during then.
Yeah, it did.
Or even more so than it did before.
Yeah, and I was kind of shocked because it actually tastes incredibly good. Like it was really good. But it definitely kicked off then.
Wasn't there a big yeast shortage during COVID too?
Yes.
Maybe.
Yes, there was a yeast shortage because all the people that were baking at home.
Yeah.
Correct.
My daughter got really into baking bread all the time. And people started hoarding those yeast packets.
Sourdough starters, right?
Like the sourdough crew. Yeah. Oh, boy. I think my brother, who also lives out on the West Coast, Brandon, I think he's into making his own beer as well. So, you know, all I remember is that anytime someone wants you to show the beer that they're making, they bring you into their garage and it just smells so bad that usually the smell turns me off of this whole homebrew idea.
Too much hops? Is that the?
I don't know what it is. It also, I think it's also triggering some PTSD from when I worked at the beer room at the Carrier Dome in Syracuse where I went to school. I would pour beer for all the hawkers that would go up and down and sell beers at the games. And so after every shift, I would just come home smelling of beer that had spilled on me during this whole process. And that turned me off to the smell of beer as well. So, all right, one more topic before we play the songs that were created. There was a cool story in the BBC.com had this week that said U.S. salaries are surging for fully in-office jobs. This whole hybrid work, back to the office, the pendulum swing back and forth. But there's now data that says that bosses are willing to pay a premium to get workers back on site. While many jobs still offer hybrid or remote working patterns, more bosses are mandating employees to return to the office on a full-time basis. But for some of these companies like Boeing, UPS, JP Morgan Chase, among others, getting workers fully back on site comes with a higher price tag, especially here in the U.S. According, you know, which has a lot of flexible working in the U.S., January 2024, around 29% of all paid workdays were still worked from home. So ZipRecruiter has data that basically says salaries for people are now higher for those that come into the office.
29.2%.
Yes.
Increase.
Whoa.
Workers who swapped from fully remote to fully in office setups in the U.S. through 2023 received a 29.2% pay bump, nearly double of that of those moving the other way. And so basically they're saying if bosses really want their workers in office, the current premium offered for a fully in-person work week is likely to remain for a while. Basically there's flexible work patterns are basically disappearing, but in order to get people back in the office, you got to pay the money is what they're saying.
I don't know if this actually comes down, and maybe it's me being cynical, but I don't know if it actually comes down to collaboration or bosses wanting people in the office or any of those things. To me, this is a story about commercial real estate.
Yes.
What we need are people back in offices so that the assets that these corporations have purchased, the physical offices, continue to retain their value so we don't slip into another recession. And we're trying to bolster that part of the economy that we're all fearful of. But when I look at downtown San Francisco, nobody's returning to work. Very few are. There's a ton of commercial real estate that has just absolutely tanked. That's the bigger story here. And if you need to pay somebody in the short term 20% more to get in and get to that critical mass, that's the message that I think that I'm seeing. Not that they actually value the people there, but they're trying to protect those other assets.
There's always the safe HR way to say it is, oh yes, we value our people and collaboration and productivity and all of those other safe buzzwords. But the reality is that you have a CFO who might be in the office that day. He walks around or she walks around and they say, and they look at these empty queues empty offices and no one's here.
Just
and
wasted money.
They just see dollar signs that are just kind of flittering away into the air.
And you can't sell it, right? Nobody's going to purchase it.
Yeah, I think in our complex here, I think just across the street, there's been empty office buildings. Like if you look through the windows, it's just emptiness. No one's buying up the lots. But I do think you're right, though. I think... if we read between the lines, I think it's a real estate issue, but deep down, I feel like it should, if they wanted to get the messaging right, it should be about collaboration and kind of being in person, you know what I mean? Team building and stuff like that, getting back to that, pre-pandemic level. But
I think the second half of that too is that a lot of managers and executives and well-to-do, people that are high performers really like the working at home aspect.
They do.
They don't want to get back either.
They don't want to drive. They just don't want to drive. Or you have people, and this has happened to some people I know, but they've actually moved locations.
Right.
So say maybe to a neighboring state or a surrounding area that's farther away, and it's they just don't want to come.
Or they've hired a new executive, and they don't work near the the old days. When you hired a new boss or a new CEO, they work in the headquarters of your wherever your headquarters are.
Right.
After the pandemic hit, I think a lot of headquarters either they closed down or they just said, all right, we're fully remote now. So now we're that was actually supposed to make the recruiting process easier because now you could have a whole different wealth of talent base to or talent pool to pick from. Does anyone have a sense of when a lot of these office leases are starting to come up and renew?
I mean, they're usually really long, right?
How long is again?
10, 20 years maybe?
Yeah.
I think 5 years is usually the minimum.
Oh, 5 years.
So 5 is the minimum.
Minimum.
So we're going to be at 5 years for the pandemic next year. So we might start seeing, again, everybody I've talked to about Office Space, because I bring this up with other people that own businesses and things like that. And one person that owned real estate in downtown Boston said that they locked out because they signed their lease maybe 2 to 3 years before the pandemic hit. During the pandemic, mm-hmm. the lease came up for renewal and they were like, nope, we're not going to renew. They gave up one of their floors that they had and, you know, basically consolidated everybody. And so they're in good shape now because they can fill that office with enough people with their policies. But we're going to start seeing that cycle. Whereas if it's up for renewal, they're going to be like, nope, we're not going to renew. And then I think you're going to see a crash. So I would say start looking at 2025 and you might see, you know, these price. Well, I think the market will probably drop a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I think the question will be, can they get people back to the office where to try and stave that off? Like that's maybe what we're seeing.
Yeah. And I guess the you've tried to threaten them. you've tried to give them free food. You've tried to give them candy to come back and water slides. And that's not, you know, sometimes money actually does talk.
Yeah. I think the money aspect of it would definitely get people to come back. I think, you know, money talks. So.
All right, Brandon, you ready to hear your song?
Can't wait.
Okay, so I'm going to read you the verses real quick, and then I'm just going to pick the first one. I'm not going to let you choose between the two. I'll email you both okay. of the songs. All right, so the first verse is, lost in the city, searching for a spot. Brandon rides his bike, but parking is all he's got. Downtown alleys, crowded streets, no place to rest his wheels, just endless beats.
Oh, God.
Pedals turning, heartache growing. Brandon feels defeated, nowhere to be going. Neon lights, blinding haze. His dad bike's destiny, stuck in this endless maze. That's actually pretty good. All right, so now the chorus is, asphalt blues, oh, they're weighing me down. Endless rounds, searching but can't be found. Brandon's on a quest, his struggle in the night. Downtown shadows, his dad bike's desperate plight. All right, you ready?
Wow.
No.
Yes.
Is that Madonna?
Is this what shoegaze sounds like? Can you hear this at all, Brandon?
It's very echoey.
Okay. That wouldn't help. All right. I think that... I want to just get to the asphalt blues part.
I just want to, yeah, give me the chorus.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, I think it's echoey a little bit too.
I can't hear it, but.
But again, the fact that was done in 2 minutes, 2 to 3 minutes was pretty amazing. So I'll send you those and then I'll figure out a way that other audience members can either that or post their own songs. I think it's cool. We'll see what happens with the company and if everyone starts using it, and then all the lawsuits will happen at some point too. All right. And I hope you can find some parking for your dad bike.
Thank you.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks again, Brandon, for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's episode. Don't forget to like the video, subscribe to the channel, add any comments that you have below. Join us every week for new episodes of Today in Tech. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time.